On today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast, Tavis Smiley explains the gulf between the rich and the rest of us. Welcome to the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. I'm Jay Frosting, here with Luke Landis, the founder of Consumerism Commentary. Hi there, Luke.
Hi, Jay.
Today, our guest is Tavis Smiley, host of Tavis Smiley on PBS and The Tavis Smiley Show from Public Radio International. He and Dr. Cornel West have published the new book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto, and recently completed a tour of the United States to discuss the issue of poverty. Mr. Smiley, welcome to the show.
Luke and Jay, good to be on. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you, and I apologize again for Dr. West not being on, but I'm delighted to have the chance to talk to both of you.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you here. And I wanted to start by addressing poverty's reach in this country. There are a lot of different ways to measure poverty, but one of the most common is to go by what the census says.
Right.
And the census has the number of 46 million Americans in poverty in 2010. And there are certain ways that we can adjust that number if we take a look and don't include Social Security payments for Americans 65 years and older, then that would add another 14 million to this total. But in your book, you're focusing on a number of 150 million who are in or near poverty in the United States. So I just wanted to get your thoughts, first of all, in who this 150 million people are.
Right. I made this point on Face the Nation on CBS. And as you might imagine, PolitiFact, which I think is probably the best resource around for checking facts made, looked into this and found there to be truth in the statement. And the answer is pretty simple, and this is what Dr. West and I based this number on. When you take the perennially poor, or put it another way, the persistently poor, you add to that the new poor. We argue in the book that the new poor are the former middle class. You add on top of that the near poor, people who are just a paycheck or two away. We call them near poor. Others call them low income. It's well documented, and all the sources are in our book. As a matter of fact, the very first footnote in the book, footnote in the appendix lays out where this data comes from, where we have realized now 150 million people in or near poverty. What that means is that half of the country is either in poverty or low income. And when you look at low income as persons who are just a couple of paychecks away from being in poverty, whether you call them poor or near poor or low income, when you add those two categories together, you're talking about half of the country. So one out of two Americans is either in or near poverty. And what we argue in the book is that when those numbers exist, your democracy is threatened. We argue in the book that poverty threatens our democracy. We argue in the book that poverty now is a matter of national security. And finally, I would just add very quickly to this point that even if you stop at your number of 46 plus 14, whatever that is, that's far too many Americans who are in poverty. Mm-hmm. But I think anyone who is being even halfway righteous in their thinking will admit that whatever the number is you want to side with, there are too many poor people in this country, number one. Number two, the gap between the rich and the poor, which is why we call this book The Rich and the Rest of Us, the gap continues to grow. And number three, we have to agree on the fact that no president since Lyndon Johnson, Republican or Democrat, has said we are going to make poverty a priority and wage a war on the poor. On those three points, I don't think we can disagree.
Yeah, absolutely. The segment of people who are one paycheck away, I'd have to assume that you met a lot of these people while you were on your tour. Could you tell me a little bit about what you might have learned from people while you were speaking about poverty?
Sure. It's a great question. So last summer, obviously as a prelude to this new book, Dr. West and I went on what we call a poverty tour. We got on a bus and gave up a good part of our summer and went to 11 states, 18 cities, talking to Americans of all races, all colors, all creeds, all party affiliations, urban, suburban, talked to a variety of Americans. We started on an Indian reservation, and Native Americans are always left out of these conversations. We, of course, spent time in the ghetto and the barrio and spent time with military veterans, went down to West Virginia, talked to, there ain't no Negroes in West Virginia, so we talked to a bunch of white folk in West Virginia. I mean, we talked to Americans of every racial stripe in this country, every ethnic stripe. And we learned a few things on the tour that we lay out in the book very quickly. Number one, in no particular order, we learned that poverty is not color-coded. For so long, when we think poverty, we think black or brown. Well, when one out of two Americans is either in or near poverty, that's like one you. Clearly, this is not a black or brown problem. This is a societal crisis, and we are getting dangerously close to cementing a permanent American catastrophe. So one, poverty is not color-coded. Number two, we learned that there is fight back out there. There are a lot of people who are being as creative as they can be, a lot of folk becoming social entrepreneurs, a lot of folk moving in with family, but people are doing everything they can, trying to find work, and that's why you see these stories every so often, not even every so often, you see these stories regularly, where Company A hosts a job fair where they're accepting applications. They only have 55 jobs, but 5,000 people show up. I mean, we see these stories on the news all the time in cities across this country. So people are trying to fight back. They're not being lazy. They're not poor because of character flaws. They're poor because of corporate greed and political indifference. And so we see fight back. And thirdly, we just saw the job numbers come out here, as you know, the new job numbers, and we see a slight uptick in the economy. The reality is that what we saw on this poverty tour, poverty is so extreme in this country, it's so deep, it's so wide, that a slight uptick in our economy is not going to solve the kind of dire poverty that we saw on this tour. So yes, there's fight back, but poverty is much deeper, it's much more broad than we want to acknowledge, and unless and until we get beyond this bipartisan consensus in Washington that the poor don't matter, that poverty is not a priority, we're not going to do anything about it. But a slight uptick in the economy is not the answer to the, as my mother would say, that's not the answer to the prayer.
Mm. You mentioned political indifference, and I want to talk about that for a minute. There was a certain candidate for president. He famously stated that he isn't concerned about the very poor because they have a safety net. And his remarks probably reflected a lot of people's opinions on the matter. Who receives the benefits of programs like welfare, Medicare, Medicaid?
It's a brilliant question. It's one of the issues that we take on in the text. There are 10 lies that are told about poor people and about poverty all the time. And the media and politicians and think tanks and others promulgate these lies all the time. We take these 10 lies on in the book. And one of those lies is about who, in fact, benefits from these kinds of programs. And it is a lie when people think or suggest that black people or brown people make up the majority of those recipients. The bottom line is this. The majority of people in this country who are in poverty happen to be white Americans. So right alongside black and brown and red and yellow are a lot of our fellow citizens who happen to be white who are being victimized by poverty run amok in this country. So that when Mr. Romney or, for that matter, Mr. Obama or any other politician runs for high office and they want to talk or speak to the angst of the middle class, and they want to talk about Medicaid or Medicare, they want to talk about Social Security, they want to talk about entitlement spending, they want to talk about austerity as the answer. They need to recognize, again, when half of the country is wrestling with poverty, and when the new poor, as we argue in this book, when the new poor are the former middle class, you can't just talk to the angst of the middle class, and if you're going to start targeting programs like Medicaid, et cetera, then you're talking to a significant slice of Americans who you're relying on to vote for you who aren't just people of color. You are, in fact, attacking programs that benefit a piece of your base. Again, since poverty isn't color-coded and it's not regional, it's all across the country, people need to think twice about these austerity measures and certain entitlement spending programs they want to cut. Now, Dr. Weston, I said in the book very quickly that we are very sensitive to the notion of deficit reduction. The debt in this country is too high. So we don't want to dismiss the fact that the deficit and the debt are real issues. On the other hand, while we're not naive about that, timing is everything, as we all know, and we think it's darn near impossible to talk about deficit reduction and to promulgate austerity as the answer when the economy is still not flowing, when too many Americans are part of what economists tell us is a jobless recovery, which I don't understand. But now is not the time to be dealing with those kinds of issues. And so, again, austerity is not the answer right now. cutting these kinds of social programs. To your earlier point, that candidate who said that he wasn't concerned about the very poor and there's a safety net for them, and if the safety net has holes in it, well, it does have holes in it, and not just small holes, not mothball-sized holes. There are gaping holes in this social safety net. And so something has got to be done, again, to make poverty a priority and to make sure that people who find themselves in this pit hole of poverty through no fault of their own can get out. Susie Orman, who we quote in this book, says, these days there's a highway into poverty and not even a sidewalk out. And so we got to have people that actually care about the poor, and this issue has got to be addressed in this campaign for the White House.
What role does education, or the lack thereof in some communities, play as a cause of poverty, and do you think it has a generational impact?
Yep. Brilliant question once again. The answer is yes and yes. Education plays a role in people being poor or not. And it can absolutely be generational. And we spend a great deal of time in the text talking about this. Dr. West, for this book, spent a lot of time with Arne Duncan, the education secretary. He and Arne Duncan agreed on some things, disagreed on others, and the narrative in the book lays out the key points in their personal dialogue about poverty in this country and the link to education. We, of course, Dr. West and I, posit our own ideas about how we have to reform education. And Doc and I don't always agree on everything, even though we're partners and co-authors and do a radio show every week. We don't agree on everything. My sense of it is, and I want to just be bold about this, in order to solve the education crisis that we have in this country, I think we got to do something really radical. And my idea is simply this, that we need a constitutional amendment. And the minute you say those two words, people, get breathless. Mm-hmm. But I think we need a constitutional amendment in this country that guarantees every child access to an equal, high-quality education. The problem is we have 50 different states that do it 50 different ways. The Obama administration's answer is race to the top. Dr. West and I said in the book that education is not a race. It ought to be a right. Education ought not be a race. It ought to be a right. Everybody deserves access to it. Now, this is not about judging outcomes, but it is about saying that every child in this country deserves to start at the same starting line when the gun goes off. If you're in Washington State, you get access to a better education because there's so many major multinational companies like Microsoft and Amazon and Starbucks, and Boeing has been there for years. There's so many major companies headquartered in Washington State that the tax base is higher. So schools in Washington have more computers. They're all wired. So if you're born in the state of Washington, you're much better off. If you're born in the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., you got problems. Mm. If you're born in Mississippi, where their greatest export is catfish, you got to eat a whole lot of catfish in Mississippi and beyond to have a tax base that gives kids access to a decent education. So Mississippi lags far behind in educational opportunities. So again, you got 50 different states, 50 ways of doing it. Even Republicans agree on this. Republicans and Democrats agree that there is an absolute link between miseducation and poverty. The less educated you are, the more likely you are to be poor. We get that. So this is not a skill problem. This is a will problem. We don't have the will yet to make poverty a priority. And for all the trash that we talk about education being the key, we don't live up to that in this country. And education, for that matter, again, back to the book, Doc and I talk in the book and cite statistics and studies and surveys that point out that for people of color especially, education isn't even the great equalizer that it once was. So that for all that we talk about education, and I'm education guy number one, but we got to be realistic about what an education means these days, how do folk get access to it, and we will never get serious about shrinking or reducing poverty in this country without understanding the link between poverty and the lack of access to a high-quality education.
The political system in this country has always favored an elite group of people, dating even back to the Founding Fathers. Anytime a group outside of the elite wants a piece of that political power, for example, women, Black Americans, labor, they can only receive that power after some type of revolution, and that kind of revolution is significant, usually violent and bloody. Is this country prepared or willing for a full-out revolution on the issue of poverty?
I think we do need a revolution. Dr. West and I unapologetically, without any equivocation or hesitation whatsoever, call for that very kind of agency to be exercised on the part of the American people. We need a values revolution in this country. We call it a values revolution. We have to be true to those American ideals that we posit all the time in conversation. We take on this notion in the book of American exceptionalism. You can't be an exceptional nation when this many people are falling into the ranks of the poor. Having said that, while we do call for revolution, we don't think it's about, the revolution ought not to be about revenge. It ought to be about justice. And we define justice as a fundamental fairness agenda that this country hasn't seemed to embrace yet, back to your question. So the rich and the lucky always get the access, and our budgets are always, our national budgets, our federal budgets are always balanced on the backs of poor people. We argue in this budget, in this book, we argue in the text, that budgets are moral documents, as I intimated earlier. Budgets are moral documents. And so when you put forth your budget, we see what your priorities really are. And so, yes, there has to be a revolution of values, a revolution of ideals. The chapters in this book pretty much tell the story. The book starts out with a chapter called A Portrait of Poverty. It's important for us to paint a portrait in this book of how we got to this place. Chapter 2 is called The Poverty of Opportunity. So we start with the fact that there is in this country a poverty of opportunity. There are people who want to work, people who have gone to school, people who have spent years in the job market and through no fault of their own, again, corporate greed, political indifference, middle class disappearing, poverty is run amok. So there is a poverty of opportunity. But beyond that, we talk in these other chapters about a poverty of affirmation, about a poverty of compassion, about a poverty of courage, a poverty of vision, a poverty of imagination. And then we take on these 10 worst lies told about poverty, and then we close this manifesto with 12 ideas that we think must be wrestled with immediately if we want to get serious about reducing and eradicating poverty. So yes, there's got to be a revolution. We call for a revolution of values, a revolution of ideals. We don't think it has to be bloody. We're not calling for anarchy, but it is important for us to understand two things very quick. Number one, what happened in Egypt and in Tunisia and in Yemen and in other places can happen in this country because 1% of the people cannot continue to own and control 42% of the wealth. The top 400 richest Americans cannot continue to own and control more wealth. The top 400 individuals have more wealth than the bottom 150 million Americans. So this is not the politics of envy. It is about, again, fundamental fairness. And to the extent that we don't start to see poverty as a threat to our democracy, to the extent that we don't start to see poverty as a threat to our national security, we're going to have some issues in this country. And my read of history suggests to me, finally, that there is no empire in the history of the world that at some point did not falter or fail. Read your history. Every empire eventually has its day. For whatever reason or reasons, be it our narcissism, our arrogance, our elitism, our patriotism, our nationalism, for whatever reason, Americans don't even want to wrestle with the fact. We do not want to marinate on the thought that we could be dangerously close to the edge, that we could be on the precipice of our democracy being in great peril, in great turmoil. So Dr. West and I, again, think the time is now to discuss the issue of poverty. It's not just a political, economic, social, or cultural issue. We argue in the book that poverty is the moral and spiritual issue of our time. And I shudder to think what happens if we don't take it seriously. Justice Louis Brandeis once put it this way. We can either have all the wealth concentrated in the hands of the few, or we can have democracy, but we can't have both.
Well, that's great information. Thank you for writing the book and for taking the time out to speak with us.
You have a great day, guys.
Thanks, you too.
That was Tavis Smiley, co-author of The Rich and the Rest of Us. Find more about the book at therichandtherestofus.com. Join us again next week for more great personal financial advice and information.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. We welcome your feedback. Please email us at podcast@consumerismcommentary.com. To subscribe to the podcast or to listen to this or other episodes, visit us at consumerismcommentary.com/pod or search for Consumerism Commentary on iTunes. The Consumerism Commentary Podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Dubeck, Brian J. Bush, and Luke Landis. The music is composed and performed by Mindcube. The podcast was founded by Luke Landis.